At this time, I'd like to turn the conference over to Patrick Ahern, Manager of Investor Relations. Please go ahead.
Morning, everybody. Thanks for joining us today to talk about our 2010 second quarter. With me in the room today are our new CEO, Ashim Ghosh, our CFO, Alistair Cowan, our COO, Rob Peabody, and our Vice President of Midstream and Refined Products, Terrence Cuttrick. Today, Ashim is going to provide an overview of Husky's strategic direction, and then Alistair will talk about the company's second quarter performance. Rob will provide an update on the upstream operations, and Terrence will conclude with talking about the midstream and downstream activities. Please note that in today's call, there will be some forward-looking information, and actual results may differ materially from the expected results because of various risk factors and assumptions which we describe in our quarterly release, in our annual filings, and those are available on SEDAR, EDGAR, and on our website. I'll now turn the call over to Ashim.
Good morning. Thank you for taking the time to join us. I've met a couple of you people before, but I'm sure most of you will be new, and so it's a meeting over the telephone, but nice to meet you anyway. I think in the circumstances, given that really there's been I'm new in the chair, before I get into a discussion of the second quarter results, it might be worth our while for me to pull ourselves back and look at the bigger picture from my fresh eyes, so to speak, viewpoint. I've been in the position actually for less than 2 months as we speak, but I've been a board member since May 2009, and I guess what I'm going to say today reflects the cumulative learnings over that more intense 2 months and the board vantage viewpoint since last May 2009. So let me start with a look at basically what I'd call in a non-financial sense, our balance sheet. And the first thing that strikes me, and I actually said this to a couple of you whom I've had the opportunity to meet, is the one thing that sticks out when you look at Husky compared to any of our peers is the completely outstanding resource base that we've got. It's a country to country across a range of types of resources, different levels of maturity, and I'll build on that theme in a minute. But the simplest quantification I can give of that is that if I take last year's production rate, we got something in excess of 60 years worth of discovered recoverable resource, and I stress the word recoverable resource, not total resource, available to this company. The second point I just touched on actually briefly is that that resource base is very diverse, and therefore we don't have an exposure to market cycles and market fads in any single type of play. You know, we are not an oil sands company, we are not an offshore company, we are not a resource company, we are all of the above. So that's the second thing that hits me. And then in the context of portfolio management, really what I say is our conventional assets in Western Canada and our heavy oil assets in the Lloyd complex are basically what I would consider as the company's bread and butter, providing a solid, sustainable foundation of cash flow. Then looking to the growth parts of the assets, we have three tremendous pillars. One is our absolutely unenviable position in the oil sands, and ranging all the way from technology still to be discovered to capitalize in Seleski, but the here and now types of top-tier resource in Sunrise. Then we got continued growth on our East Coast, where we haven't really very, very strong position, but while it has already delivered, with further investment, it still has material long life and, in fact, upside ahead of it. And finally, of course, we got our growth opportunity in Southeast Asia. So that's it for the portfolio part of it. The second part I want to highlight is that sticks out to anybody coming in fresh into this company is a very defined, strong corporate culture, which has a number of elements to it. I'll speak to them in a minute. But, you know, corporate cultures are intangibles. They cannot be put down on a piece of paper. They evolve over decades, and in this case, you're talking like 7 decades. So we got a very talented and dedicated employee base. And the better, the backbone of a company is its middle management. And this company has got middle management that has been with the company for decades, that has a depth of knowledge of the business and a commitment to the business. And I'll dwell on another very strong part of the culture in my next section. Secondly, there's a very strong safety culture, and Rob will expand on this later. And we are not talking of this because safety happens to be sort of very top of mind right now. It is something that hit me as soon as I joined this company and got on the board and actually got on the health and safety committee. So, I mean, that in itself was symbolic for you, that a new director comes in and he gets in the health and safety committee. So it is not something that is faddish for us. And we have in that employee base and through our work, skills and technology leading positions in several core producing areas, such as heavy oil, such as East Coast, which are great enablers to our business strategies going forward. The third strength I want to mention, and again, this is really an amplification of culture, is our cost consciousness. This company, I mean, I was talking to one of my industry colleagues who's been in this company for a few years, but he's been around and he's been a number of companies. And when we're doing a SWOT analysis of the company, and this guy has more perspective than virtually anybody I've met in the oil industry, says, you know, hey, where would you rate Husky on cost consciousness? He said, immediate words, best in class. So by cost consciousness, I don't mean cost cutting. I mean a basic, innate ethos of prudent, disciplined allocation of capital, of budgetary control, of execution, which is deeply ingrained in our culture. The final differentiator I will mention again, because this sets up to what a point I'm leading up to, is our strong balance sheet. And as you know, John and the management team before me have worked diligently to create and maintain a strong balance sheet. And on both a relative and I would say absolute basis, we have low debt levels, which has been a key Husky strength. However, a strong balance sheet is only an advantage if we use it wisely to create shareholder value, and that's the topic I will touch on in a minute. Coming now to the issue of the day. So as I said, the company is extremely well positioned for the long term, but we do have, and let's call a spade, some short-term issues around production. In 2008, In 2008, as the economic markets went into, as the markets went into a bit of turmoil, we took a very prudent approach in managing financial position, as you'll recollect, and we spoke about it at the time. And we had a number of long-term projects which we didn't want to jeopardize, because that would jeopardize the position of Husky in the long term. So therefore, we did trade off some short-term production opportunities, knowing at that point that there would be a price to be paid, you know, in the 18 to 24-month period, and we are seeing some of that now. So while we have emerged from the recession in a very strong financial position, we are seeing that impact on the current production levels, and therefore, I would say my single action point at this point in time is while maintaining the integrity of our long-term projects, we are going to rebalance our portfolio. We will direct a measure of our capital to those low-cost, high-return projects which give us a reasonably short-term returns. And by short-term, in the oil industry context, you know, this is not like telecom where I come from, but this is, so we are really talking 18 to 24 months from now. We start to see the impacts of those. And the goal would be to build a production bridge while maintaining the integrity of our long-term objectives. So how are we going to do this? Well, some of the investment, our capital investment, will shift towards our bread and butter shop in our core Western Canada areas. And over the next few quarters, we'll be identifying opportunities and taking action to increase that short-term organic growth. And as I just mentioned, we should see the response in 12 to 18 months. And we will also, more importantly, that's for the organic part, but in an organic sense, we will be completely open to acquisitions of properties which give us currently flowing barrels in a, I stress, completely intrinsic to our culture, value-conscious way. And to put some further perspective on these acquisitions, we are looking for opportunities, the word I've used, we're looking for opportunities with strategic contiguity with what we've got, i.e. acquisitions that are either near or adjacent to our existing operations where we can realize synergies, or acquisitions where we can apply our technical skills to realize value. You won't see us going up to Afghanistan or offshore India or other sexy parts that are thing. No, we are going to stick to the knitting because that is what Husky is good at, because this company has a lot of experience in knitting certain things, and it's kind of something that comes historically naturally to me. Okay. So going forward, how will we add more shareholder value? So you've had discussion on this before, but it's worth reiteration in the context of a change of guard. The first pillar of growth, of course, is oil sands. And as I said earlier, this company has an incredible oil sands resource base, and those are going to play an increasingly prominent role in our production profile. And as you know, it is an exciting story to tell, because our portfolio includes projects that contain over, order of magnitude, 50 billion barrels of discovered petroleum initially in place, of which 4 billion are recoverable using today's known here and now technology. I mean, these projects alone, when commercialized, could double Husky's production in time. Now, the first major new project, of course, is Sunrise, which is a top-tier resource, and we are making good progress on its development. We should receive the tenders, today is the 28th, so the closure date is within this month, and we are on track to sanction the project by year-end. We are confident that these vital resources, and I believe they are vital for the energy needs of today's world, will be developed within the context of our commitment to safety and our focus on responsible environmental stewardship, because that again is something that is core to the heart of Husky's value system. The second pillar of growth is the leading position we built already on East Coast. And while White Rose has been very profitable, it will continue production from the main field. But and I just want to put some perspective on it. I guess if you take the total amount of money we put out into White Rose, we recovered, 3.5 times, Alistair, I'd say, over the 7-year time frame. So yeah. 3.5 times that. Yeah. So that's some perspective on where White Rose has been. But it is in decline. So we believe we can increase resource recovery from White Rose above the 30 to 35% level under the current development scheme. We are assessing development opportunities of other near-field tiebacks and production from other reservoir zones, such as the Hibernia Formation. We've been advancing our study of development alternatives for large gas resource in the area, which currently, of course, as you know, we are not harvesting. It's being pumped back in. As many of you know, there's, I think, in excess of 2 TCF of gas in the White Rose field alone. And, our East Coast portfolio basically includes 23 significant discoveries in the offshore Newfoundland Labrador area. So it's a land position second to none. The third pillar of growth is the exciting story that continues to emerge from Southeast Asia. The core Wan Chang oil field in the Pearl River mouth basin keeps contributing to high netback production, and development work is continuing on the significant Levan gas discovery. Now, some of you are aware, we spoke about this before, about the possibility of a spin-off. So we are evaluating in detail whether a spin-out and a separate listing of our Asian assets represents the best way to maximize a value for the shareholders, or all our shareholders, minority and significant shareholders. But in any such transaction, it goes without saying that meticulous attention must be paid to legal, to regulatory, to tax considerations in Canada and also in the countries where these assets are operated. So that work is currently underway, and we would be in a position to make a definitive recommendation before year end. I don't want to preempt any conclusions. As I said, that is something we are simply studying at this point in time. Coming now to the quarter, I'm going to hand over to my colleagues, Rob, CEO, whom many of you have met in previous calls, and Alistair, our CFO. But basically, I just want to repeat a couple of highlight points that a key goal at this point for the company is to deliver near-term production growth. To that intent, and we talked about acquisitions, so we have actually mentioned this in our press release that we've just recently signed a letter of intent to purchase some natural gas producing properties which are currently flowing barrels which meet the criteria of synergies with existing processing infrastructure. So we believe it is value accretive and is spot on strategy, and you know we should be in a position to give you greater details of this once the SPAs are signed and the regulatory approvals are obtained. On that note, let me hand you over to Alistair for a more detailed look at the results. Alistair.
Thanks, Ashim. I'm going to take the next few minutes and just walk us through the financial results for the second quarter. And as you see, these clearly reflect the impact of the current economic conditions on the different parts of our business. From an overall perspective, we generated cash flow from operations in the second quarter of $806 million, which is comparable to the same period last year, and net earnings of $266 million were, however, lower than last year, as you've seen. There were four key factors which influenced our financial performance, and I will give you some more color on each of these in a moment. They were lower product margins in the downstream segment, lower production, higher realized commodity pricing, and increased depletion expense in Southeast Asia. If you look at our U.S. downstream business, the results reflect the continued weak economic demand, which has kept market crack spreads similar year over year. When you look at our realized refining margins, they are impacted by product differences from arising as a result of our refinery configuration for Toledo and Lima, and the transportation costs from benchmark hubs to those refineries in Ohio. We have different accounting policies for the purchase of crude oil compared to the benchmark pricing, and we have the translation impact of the stronger Canadian dollar. Looking at our downstream business, you need to understand that our realized refining margins will always be different from the quoted benchmarks, and I'll give you a couple of reasons why. Benchmark crack spreads, such as Chicago 321, are calculated based on standard ratios of gasoline and distillate products, but our product slate produced at Lima and Toledo refineries contain roughly 10 to 15% of other products, which are typically sold at much lower market prices compared to gasoline and distillate. Our realized refining margins are also affected by the accounting, the different accounting treatment for the purchase of crude oil. We have a time lag between the time we purchase and deliver the crude oil to the refinery, and we account for purchases on a first-in, first-out basis, and that's in accordance with generally accepted accounting principles in Canada. Benchmark pricing that you see in the markets, however, is calculated on a last-in, first-out basis, which essentially reflects market pricing. Overall, the net result is that the financial performance of our downstream business will typically be better in times of rising crude oil. The absolute price of crude oil is not as important as the trend of pricing when trying to assess performance. If you look at the second quarter of 2010, crude oil prices were relatively stable. Therefore, the impact of FIFO LIFO accounting was minimal. However, in the same period of 2009, crude oil prices rose significantly. They were up 44% from the end of March 2009 to the end of June 2009. As a result, our realized refining margin in 2009 reflected that increase due to that six-week time lag between the purchase and delivery of crude oil to the refinery. The strengthening of the Canadian dollar year over year, which is up 13% against the US dollar compared to 2009, also reduced the results this quarter of our downstream business when we translated them back into Canadian dollars. As the team highlighted, overall production was down in the quarter and is a clear focus for the near term. Our liquids production in the second quarter was lower compared to last year due to peak production rate decline from the White Rose field and lower heavy oil production resulting from the lower capital expenditures in 2009. On the East Coast, our production will stabilize with the North Amethyst satellite, which commenced production at the end of May this year. Our average natural gas production was similar to levels in the second quarter of 2009, but was impacted by some scheduled plant turnaround activity in the quarter. Benchmark commodity prices denominated in US dollars were up significantly from the same quarter in 2009, as you know, but the strengthening of the Canadian dollar did reduce the impact of these higher prices when we translated them back. That resulted in a 15% increase in Canadian dollar pricing for commodity prices versus a 31% increase in US dollar pricing. So you can see the significant impact there on our results. Turning now to Southeast Asia, we did have higher depletion expense during the 2010 and the quarter, and that's as a result of our increased activity as we continue to execute on our exploration plans as we build our material oil and gas business in the region, which is our strategic objective. Operationally, we announced the successful testing of the first appraisal well at the Lihua 29-1 discovery on block 2926 with encouraging results. And we also made another natural gas discovery at the Lihua 3441 exploration well, and that's our fourth discovery on block 2926. As Asim said, we're firmly committed to the development of the Liwan gas discovery, and we do expect to sanction that project later this year. Turning now to the balance sheet, we remain in a strong financial position. Our total debt at June 30th, net of cash and cash equivalents, was $3.9 billion. Our debt to cash flow and debt to capital employed ratios at the same date were 1.4 times and 21.6% respectively on a trailing 12-month basis. Now, both of these ratios remain well within our target ranges, and they do provide Husky with the flexibility to take advantage of value-adding opportunities as they arise. As we announced earlier this morning, Husky's Board of Directors has approved a quarterly dividend of 30 cents per share. I'm now going to turn you over to Rob, and he's going to give you some more details on upstream operations.
Okay, thanks, Alistair. I wanted to start out with some remarks on safety and operational integrity, as I always do when I'm talking to my operations team. A good measure of occupational safety is our total recordable incident rate. Performance for the first half of the year was 1.15. And just to put that in context, since we often think of these as metrics as opposed to what they actually mean underlying, that means that in 200,000 man-hours, we'd expect a medical aid or a lost time injury to one of our workers. Or thought about another way, it means that if an average worker worked 100 years, they would expect to have one medical aid or one lost time injury. And this is, in this case, in the last quarter, that would be 1.15 in our case. And that's comparable to our performance in 2009. Husky's 2010 target is to be less than one, and we're continuing to drive towards that goal. You've also been making good progress in implementing the Husky Operational Integrity Management System, known as HOIMS, that we first adopted in 2007. HOIMS is a comprehensive system that integrates elements of process safety, occupational safety, and environmental stewardship, all under one umbrella. This is the way forward that will provide for the safety of our employees, our contractors, our neighbors, and our assets. I now want to talk about production. We've completed a comprehensive review of operational activities in the first half of the year and an assessment of activities in the second half of the year. As a result, we are adjusting our 2010 production guidance to 285 to 295,000 barrels of oil equivalent per day, and we expect to exit the year at around 300,000 barrels per day. The main reason for this adjustment was the delay in the North Amethyst startup, and that had an impact of about 10,000 barrels per day versus our original forecast, and that was combined with modestly lower production from our heavy oil operations compared to our original forecast. Compared to 2009, as Alistair previously mentioned, production for the quarter was impacted by lower rates from the main White Rose field, which is part of its natural decline, and heavy oil production as a result of the reduced capital expenditures, as I previously mentioned. Planned maintenance turnarounds, looking forward for the remainder of the year, that will impact upstream production include a 24-day shutdown, planned shutdown at Terra Nova, which is currently in progress, and a 16-day shutdown at White Rose, which is planned for October. North Amethyst production, which is currently around 20,000 barrels per day, will ramp up as additional wells are drilled and brought on stream. Production should reach a gross peak rate of around 37,000 barrels per day in 2011. 25,000 barrels a day of that is net to Husky. Turning to upstream growth projects, as Ashane said earlier, a key goal is to deliver near-term production growth. And I'd like to update you on some of the steps we are taking to accelerate production growth while continuing to build a foundation for the long term. First, starting in Western Canada, where the future for Husky in Western Canada is really going to be about developing a number of gas resource plays, a number of oil resource plays, and applying new technology, new enhanced oil recovery technology to our extensive portfolio of fields, mature fields. So, just going into some of the specifics of that, at Ansell, two wells were drilled in the quarter to test multi-target zones. In the second half of the year, we plan to drill an additional 50 gas wells at Ansell, where the economics are supported by high liquids yields that come along with the gas production. Husky continues to build a position in a number of gas resource plays and now holds more than 952,000 net acres in established assets in the Alberta foothills and in northeast British Columbia. In the second quarter, Husky acquired additional land in Bivouac, located in British Columbia, as well as deepened our holdings in the Ansel area. Oil resource play evaluation and testing activity continued in the quarter. Six Viking wells were placed on production in the Dogland Elrose area in southwest Saskatchewan to bring the total number of producing wells in the play to 11. An additional 15 wells are planned for Redwater in the remainder of the year. Evaluation wells are currently in progress to assess the Cardium at Lanaway, the Lower Shaunavon in southwest Saskatchewan, and the Bakken in southeast Saskatchewan. Moving over to the heavy oil segment, we are increasing our drilling activity. In 2010, we plan to drill around 290 CHOPS wells and 84 horizontal wells, compared to around 175 CHOPS and 27 horizontal wells we drilled in 2009. So you'll see that's a significant increase in activity in this critical area. The horizontal wells are interesting because This is a new technique we're using to access thinner reservoirs in the Lloydminster area, which opens up the potential for increased recovery. At McMullen, an additional 32 wells are planned for the second half of the year to further exploit the heavy oil production potential of this lease. And looking at McMullen, we see potential in thermal development of the lease, and we're doing some work on scoping that development now. But we've also found a good opportunity in just cold production on the lease, cold production of heavy oil, which, of course, is something we're very experienced at based on our Lloydminster operations. We are currently also constructing an 8,000 barrel per day thermal project at South Pikes Peak, which follows on our very successful Bolney, Celtic, and Pikes Peak projects that are currently on production. The project is approximately 30% complete at the end of the second quarter, and we're expecting to start that project up in 2012. And this is really the first stage of a successive number of these additional thermal projects aimed at doubling our current heavy oil thermal production from its current level of around 20,000 barrels per day. Turning to the East Coast, we've had a very busy quarter at the North Amethyst field. And well, as I previously mentioned, we brought the field on about 3 months later than our original forecast due to the availability of drilling rigs over the winter. We actually did get this project on stream 30 months after sanctioned and less than 4 years after discovery, which is a tremendous achievement by the team out there, and I personally am very proud of what they've done. In the quarter, Husky and its partners also extended the agreement for the Henry Goodrich offshore drilling rig. And this will enable Husky to continue the development of the White Rose and adjacent oil fields through January 2013. And of course, one of those is the West White Rose pilot, which we're looking to get approval from very shortly. We're expecting that from the regulator so that we can move ahead there. Now, finally, moving to oil sands. Husky continues to progress the development of the Sunrise Energy Project, as Ashim mentioned earlier, and we are just about ready to, we expect the tenders in by the end of this month, and we expect to get contractor selection done in over the third quarter and sanction the project before the end of the year. I also wanted to update you on some work we have underway at Tucker. As many of you know, Tucker's issues are largely related to the subsurface, and we've conducted a detailed review of Tucker, which started at the beginning of 2009. And the objectives of that study and what we managed to achieve with it was, first, to optimize the project's forward development. Second, we wanted to make sure we captured all the learnings from Tucker. And then, because those learnings have applicability both clearly to Sunrise, we wanted to make sure any learnings that were applicable were applied to the design of Sunrise, but also to our other oil sands leases, because Husky has an extensive portfolio of other leases. And so that's what we did, and also critically, we wanted to confirm that our projections for the Sunrise project remain robust going forward, and we're confident of that. So we believe now that the forward plan for Tucker can achieve economics comparable to the original approval case. However, this is only possible because higher bitumen prices today will offset projected higher steam oil ratios and lower production because of the reservoir quality we see at Tucker. In the quarter at Tucker, we drilled three new well pairs and tied in and put on, three new well pairs were tied in and put on steam. An additional four well pairs were drilled. These wells incorporate a number of design changes, and their performance will prove if our revised development plan is on track. And we should have good confirmation of that by around the middle of 2011. Terrence will now talk about the midstream and our midstream and downstream activities, which, of course, are strongly linked to our heavy oil and oil sands business and growth plans.
Thanks, Rob. as Rob's emphasized, Husky does have a strong position in heavy oil. And while there is a specific market for that product, the reason we are in the midstream business is to maximize its value and capture synergies, including transport and upgrading. With respect to the upgrader, throughput for the second quarter averaged 73,500 barrels per day, with operating costs of $6.60 per barrel. The upgrader is scheduled for its planned five-year turnaround to begin in September for approximately 53 days. Now, I would like to make a few comments on our downstream activities. This sector captures the full value from our heavy oil and bitumen production and minimizes income and cash flow volatility. Now, despite the challenging refining economic conditions, throughput was up in the quarter for U.S. and Canadian refining at 253,000 barrels per day, compared with 230,000 barrels per day in 2009. And this year's performance reflects the improved operations at Lima following the very successful turnaround in 2009. Lima is going to complete the remaining portion of its five-year turnaround in November of this year. And at that time, it's going to operate at reduced rates of approximately 100,000 barrels per day. To refresh your memory, in our retail area, our retail network extends from British Columbia through to the Quebec border. Husky continues to progress with our integration of newly acquired 98 retail stations in southern Ontario. And they will continue to provide us with some future optionality for our Ohio refinery production. Rebranding is underway. We've completed 37 sites, and the remaining locations will be brought into the network in the last 6 months of 2010. I'll now turn the call back to Patrick.
Thanks, Terrence. That's it for the opening part of the call. And now we'd be pleased to have any questions that you might have. So I'm going to turn it back to Brock for questions from our participants, starting with the analyst community, and then we'll take any questions from the media.
Thank you, sir. If you wish to ask a question, please press star, then one on your touch-tone telephone. If you wish to remove yourself from the question queue, you may press star, then two. Once again, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star, then one at this time. Our first question today comes from Andrew Potter of CIBC World Markets. Please go ahead.
Yeah, hi guys. Two quick questions. First, could you give us a little bit more detail on the land positions in the Bakken, Shaunavon, Viking, and Cardium? Or I guess alternatively, maybe just talk about kind of the resource potential you see there. And second, maybe if you can just give a little bit more color on Liwan in terms of kind of what you're currently thinking in terms of cost estimates and gas marketing arrangements, and I guess if you can't comment on that, when will we start to see that definition? Thanks.
So,
Andrew, I'll take that one. On the oil resource plays, as I say, we have positions in the Pembina, Cardium, in the Bakken, in a number of different areas. We also have positions in the Viking, which is an area we have some fairly, you know, for historic reasons as well, some pretty good land positions. Husky has a large land position in Western Canada, and of course, you know, occasionally you get some good overlap with some new plays regardless. So we've actually built ourselves a position where, in aggregate, we think we have something in the order of over 500,000 acres of prospective land in oil resource plays. And we're still in the process. I mean, you can understand with the wells we're putting into these resource plays to actually understand the potential of each one of those plays. And I don't want to go into our own internal assessments at this stage of where we think that potential is, but we do think it's substantial, and certainly as we go forward, we see it as a key component of our growth plan in Western Canada. And I think that the only other thing I'd say is that I think as the result of new technology we've seen being introduced into the basin, both in terms of gas resource plays and oil resource plays and EOR, we now feel that the Western Canada Basin, excluding heavy oil and oil sands, has the potential for growth over the next 5 years.
Alistair, you may want to take the second one, I guess.
Yeah, thanks, Ashim. Liwan, from the gas marketing perspective, the gas will go into the Hong Kong and Guangdong area in China, and we're certainly in the process of discussions with some key long-term buyers in that area, and I would expect that we should be able to have something to report on that by the end of this year. On the cost side, clearly the engineering, the FEED is done. We're looking at estimates and bids from various contractors. We'd expect to be able to give you more color on that when we sanction that project later this year and we get ODP approval, which we'd expect to file in the next couple of months.
Sure. And maybe another way of approaching the question on Lee Wan, that is, you know, based on kind of the early indications you're seeing on the cost side, maybe, you know, what oil or what oil linked gas price would you need to see to make this a viable project? Just trying to get a sense in terms of how robust the economics are on this project.
What I would point you to, Andrew, is if you look at what our sort of LNG prices that are going to go into, that are currently going into that region in Asia, and you should expect that we'll be probably something similar to that level. That makes it a very robust project.
Okay, that's great. Thanks a lot.
Next.
The next question comes from Mark Pollock of Scotia Capital. Please go ahead.
Hi, good morning, guys. Just curious on the natural gas acquisition, if you could give us what the effective date of that acquisition would be and if those the 10,000 BOE a day is included in your current guidance.
Well, the 10,000 BOE is a run rate. The key issue really for us is regulatory clearances, which, you know, we don't control the timing of, but we would expect perhaps, I mean, you've signed the LOI, so somewhere in the order of a quarter to get the all the clearances, so 3 to 4 months to get all the clearances, basically. Yeah, okay.
Okay, and then wondering if you could update us on the sort of the ramp-up progress on North Amethyst and when you see that getting up to design rates.
Rob, you may want to speak to that one.
Yes. Okay, thanks, Hashim. North Amethyst, we're currently producing in the range of about 20,000 barrels a day with the first production well. We're looking to bring the second production well on stream in late August, if all the completion operations go to plan. Then we have to drill a second water injector. You can think of these as well pairs into the reservoir. And so when we bring the first production well on, it'll be at relatively low rates until that water injector comes on stream. And that water injector that coming on stream is linked to the turnaround we're doing in October at the facility. And then we'll bring on further wells. We'll be drilling and completing further injectors and producers as we move into next year. So I hope, does that give you a good feel for it?
That does. Thank you very much.
The next question comes from Greg Pardy of RBC Capital Markets. Please go ahead.
Hi, good morning. Just a couple of questions, morning team. What are the, maybe just to go back to Lee Wan Gas, what are the steps that you still need to take in order to sanction the project and then to move to commerciality?
I'll take that.
Thanks. Greg, we need to finalize negotiations on the gas contracts with the major off-takers, and that's well in hand. We need to just finalize the commercial agreements with CNOOC, our partner, on the shallow water facilities and the onshore facilities. The dewater facilities are all clearly laid out in the production sharing contract. Once we finalize that, we'll file for ODP approval, and we'd expect that, you know, in a few months, and then we'd move to sanction the project.
Okay, thanks very much. And then maybe just a question for Rob. I mean, you know, you look at where heavy oil differentials have been over the last couple of years, and we see the Lloyd numbers, you know, well under 100,000 barrels a day now. Within the 300,000 barrel a day exit rate, you were talking about how much of that would be Lloyd. You know, do you think you're back up above 100,000 by the end of this year? And what kind of running room do you see then in driving the business? I know you've referred to doubling the thermal, which is, I think, 20,000 now, but just want to get a broader sense of how big that business will get.
Yeah, okay, thanks. I mean, first and foremost, I think, yes, if you think about the 300,000 barrels a day, total heavy oil production for Husky is around 100,000 barrels a day. Some of that comes from outside of the Lloyd complex, a small amount of it. Most of it's from within the Lloyd complex. I think there's a number of new technologies coming along to increase recoveries in the heavy oil area. Currently, again, just to take you back to the basics, you know, Lloydminster has about a little over Husky's lands in Lloydminster, a little over 10 billion barrels of oil in place. And currently, the CHOPS technology that we've traditionally used on these gives you about a 700 million barrels of recoverable reserves, of which around 7% of the total. Looking forward, we're looking at a number of new technologies. Thermal is clearly a technology we've used and have proven very well, but you can only use it in portions of the Lloydminster area. You can think of this as a large deposit of heavy oil, but it had channels running through it, which creates thicker sections of the reservoir, and that's where we can use thermal techniques, and that's where we expect to be able to increase production from the current sort of 20,000 barrels a day up towards something approaching double that number going forward. But there are other technologies like our horizontal wells allowing us to access thinner reservoirs, and we actually have a number of others, including looking further out, cold enhanced production, which we've talked about a few times before, where we have a number of pilots that have shown very good technical results, and we continue to work them to turn that into ultimately commercial results going forward with further development. So all those things are giving us a lot of confidence about the very long-term future of the Lloydminster resource. And one of the things I like to say is, I mean, there's a lot of interest and excitement about various resource plays out there at the moment, but I like to refer to Lloydminster as the original oil resource play. It's been producing, you know, very large volumes for a very, very long time.
It is.
Yeah.
It's a 60-year-old resource play.
And we believe it has very long legs going forward. Now, how much growth we'll see coming out of that going forward, our immediate targets with all this technology ultimately are to continue to deliver that 100,000 barrels a day over an extended period of time. We do see the potential for increasing that, but that depends on a number of these technologies working out and how rapidly we apply them, clearly, because we're always fighting a decline curve. But the idea is, and again, in my mind, I link quite closely the heavy oil business and the oil sands business. There's a lot of commonality there. And if we can hold Lloydminster at 100,000 barrels a day, we may be able to do better than that. But if we can do that for a long period of time and then grow our oil sands portfolio, as Ashim mentioned earlier in his talk, where we think that alone, excluding heavy oil, has the potential to double Husky's current production over time, we think we've got a great business there.
Okay, no thanks, Rob. Just a couple of last points then. Around the CapEx, you're keeping base CapEx unchanged at $3.1 billion. So are you just more or less just changing the lineup here for the balance of the year? And then to go back maybe to Mark's question, you know, it looks as though like hitting your gas volumes for the year, you'd need to more or less hold the volumes flat to a slight incline during the balance of the year. So is the 60 million a day acquisition in the numbers, in the guidance numbers?
Okay, I'll do the capital side up. On the capital side, yeah, we've maintained our capital guidance at this point. We're currently going through an extensive evaluation project on a process on various options to accelerate our capital. Once we've been through that in the next few weeks, we'll be able to have a clearer picture of just exactly what we're going to shift around in our portfolio. Some of it will be projects we won't do. Some of it will be additional projects. So I think in a couple of months, we'll be able to give a much clearer picture on how much extra, if any, there will be on our capital side. And on the gas...
First, just on the guidance, maybe coming back, I think we've had the question a few times a little bit about, you know, is that extra production volume in the guidance? And on a run rate basis, since we can only sort of book production after that acquisition closes, we're talking a little bit of, you know, somewhere between you know, depending on when you get closure, sometime between 2,000 and 3,000 barrels a day or something that would act in terms of an average addition to this year. So I just say within the range of guidance we've quoted, it's not material and it's within that range at some point. In terms of gas production, we certainly expect to kind of hold gas flat. Well, I think if you look over the year, I mean, we'll finish off the year a little bit above 500 million, in very close to our original guidance for the year. I think gas production has been holding up pretty well relative to our original forecast, and the work we're doing in the second half of this year should actually, if anything, slightly increase gas production over the second half of the year. And of course, as we've previously mentioned too, this quarter was heavily impacted, as it is most year, by turnarounds of our gas plants and pipelines, some of the pipelines that are servicing our gas plants, the second quarter being the biggest quarter for turnarounds every year.
Wonderful. Thanks very much.
Once again, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone. The queue is now open to the media as well. The next question comes from Mike Dunn of First Energy Capital. Please go ahead.
Yeah, good morning, gentlemen. Probably a question for Terrence. Just wondering if you can, if you guys have the numbers on what the FX rate impact was on your U.S. Downstream results for the quarter.
Well, I'll take that one. It's hard to, because the numbers of the underlying business is different, but the Canadian dollar, the average Canadian dollar, strengthened by 13% year over year in the quarter. So if you look at the results that we have, it's approximately about $10-15 million.
Okay, yeah, I guess I should have been more clear, Alistair, just with respect to your inventory costs and the FIFO. With respect to your inventory pricing and cash.
As I said in the in my comments, I mean, we are a FIFO company. We don't account for it on a LIFO basis. We do, however, kind of make some educated estimates on it. You could never audit any number on those, but you know, if the price in the quarter was relatively flat, therefore the impact of LIFO in this quarter is quite small. If you look at last year, you know, you saw prices go from $48 to $65, $69 by the end of June. So there was a big impact in last year's numbers, and it's relatively straightforward to be able to calculate that.
So you basically kind of take the differential and you assume an inventory of around
12 million barrels.
12 million barrels, and you do the math, but we are not allowed to give you an auditable statement on it because our system captures actual realized crack. We don't officially, you know, we do an estimate on inventory impact, but you can do the math on it. I've given you all the components to do the estimate the way we do it.
Okay, thanks. And on the gas assets that you purchased, can you guys tell us whereabouts in Alberta those assets are?
I think all I'm at, you know, this deal is subject to confidentiality.
Okay.
And therefore, you know, it takes two in a marriage, and husband can't speak without wife's consent. But basically, what I do want to make the point is it meets our stated strategic criteria tightly in terms of having synergy with our core competences and our core physical capabilities. You must bear with me. I think that's all I can say at this point in time.
Great. Thank you.
The next question comes from Andrew Fairbanks of Bank of America. Please go ahead.
Thanks. Good morning, guys. Just curious what you've seen in terms of consistency and maybe some of the IP well rates in your Viking tight oil plays.
Bob, do you want to take that?
Sorry, what? Can you repeat? Did you say consistency or?
Yeah, I just was curious if you had any observations on the Viking Dodland wells you've drilled, how consistent the results have been as you've begun to roll out that program, and then if you had any additional data around those wells, that would be helpful also.
Well, I don't really want to go into that right now because I don't know who's on the line. There might be someone listening from our competitors or something. So So, but we are seeing very encouraging results in the Viking, and we believe we have an economic business that we can develop there.
Oh, very good. And any other comments on any of your ASP pilot flood activity? Do you see that as prospective?
Sorry, the ASP?
ASP pilot flood.
Yeah, no, we continue. I wouldn't call ASP piloting. I mean, we're on our fourth project, and we get good results from those projects. Husky's the leader in the application of ASP technology, certainly in North America, if not the world. And we're seeing good results, good economics, and we have a significant number of projects we intend to apply that technology to going forward.
Yeah, I mean, this is not meant to be self-congratulatory, guys. So, you know, if there's any hyperbole in what Rob said.
Thanks.
The next question comes from Rob Billion of Concentrata Financial. Please go ahead. Mr. Billion, your line is open.
Hi. My question is within regards to the dividend. When you guys cut the dividend from 50 cents to 30 cents, they said it was a goal of the company to bring it back to 50 cents. Can you just elaborate a bit on that within with the goals now with to increase production and everything? Thank you.
No, at this point in time, the dividend is what it is, and there are no immediate plans to increase or decrease the dividend because, as we've indicated, I mean, the continuing thrust is that we are in an investment mode, and that's where it'll be. So the dividend policy is, of course, reviewed from time to time. And we've just done a review and stayed where we are.
Thank you.
The next question comes from George Torolia of UBS Securities. Please go ahead.
Thanks. This question is for Azim. Just in terms of the you talked about your potential M&A transactions, the way you're looking at M&A transactions, just wondering if you can provide a bit more color in terms of scale or the things you look for, production growth. You've talked about production growth in the near term being a key focus. Would that be the driver for your for any potential acquisitions here, or would it be a running room, or would it be a combination of both? Would it be long life assets? What would you be looking for exactly?
Well, good question, and I think it's worth putting some clarity on that. The prime focus of acquisitions at this point would be currently flowing barrels within the context of strategic contiguity. And I've defined strategic contiguity, which is basically stuff that's contiguous to where we are geographically or stuff that's contiguous within our core skills. If, as a corollary, we get additional long-life assets, that is gravy, but this company has got so many long-life assets already in its portfolio, that is not the focus for the additional effort we are putting in now.
Okay.
Secondly, we are agnostic to oil or gas. It's really a matter of valuation. And thirdly, we would like to stay within conventional technology. Again, if there are some additional possibilities coming with the asset in terms of the application of unconventional for the longer life, that is gravy, but that is not the focus.
Okay, thanks a lot. What about scale? Are you able to talk about that at all in terms of
materiality? When you announce that you're in the acquisition mode, there's already a danger of prices going up. And if I start to mention scale, the prices may go up further. So I think at this point in time, I would like to keep our cards closer to our chest. But clearly,
we are interested in making a material impact on our production in the near term, and in the near term I'm really defining is the next 12 months.
Okay, thanks a lot.
There are no further questions at this time. I'd now like to turn the conference over to Ashin Ghosh for any closing comments.
Well, thank you. I would like to thank you for your questions. Thank you for joining us on this, my first call. I just want to end on a sort of a very simple recap, if I may, of what I told you earlier. Basically, I feel very good about the very solid resource for this base that this company has. We do have a unique portfolio. We do have a strong balance sheet. Our Western Canada and heavy oil asset base do provide a very strong foundation for us to work forward, both in terms of production, more importantly, sort of cash flow and short-term continued production growth from there, combined with the acquisitions. Mid to long term, we are extremely well positioned on oil sands, and we have already taken active steps to commercialize those opportunities. We continue to have transformational opportunities on the East Coast, and we continue to build a material oil and gas business in Southeast Asia. And I do want to say this because actually we've made a fetish of saying this in all of our internal operational meetings in the company, but it bears repetition in the context of our more public conference call, is that whatever we do will be governed within the four pillars of safe work practices. So thank you for your questions. Thank you for joining us. Much appreciated. Goodbye.
Ladies and gentlemen, the conference is now concluded. You may disconnect your telephones. Thank you for joining and have a pleasant day. Goodbye.